Their hostile fleets were associated under the standard of St. Peter. The kingdoms of Hungary and Poland, which covered, as it were, the interior pale of the Latin Church, were the most nearly concerned to oppose the progress of the Turks. Arms were the patrimony of the Scythians and Sarmatians, and these nations might appear equal to the contest, could they point, against the common foe, those swords that were so wantonly drawn in bloody and domestic quarrels. But the same spirit was adverse to concord and obedience. A poor country and a limited monarch are incapable of maintaining a standing force, and the loose bodies of Polish and Hungarian horse were not armed with the sentiments and weapons which, on some occasions, have given irresistible weight to the French cavalry. Yet on this side, the designs of the Roman pontiff and the eloquence of Cardinal Julian, his legate, were promoted by the circumstances of the times. By the union of the two crowns on the head of Ladislaus, a young and ambitious soldier. By the valor of a hero whose name, the name of John Hunyadis, was already popular among the Christians and formidable to the Turks. An endless treasure of pardons and indulgences was scattered by the legate. Many private warriors of France and Germany enlisted under the holy banner, and the crusade derived some strength, or at least some reputation, from the new allies both of Europe and Asia. A fugitive despot of Serbia exaggerated the distress and ardor of the Christians beyond the Danube, who would unanimously rise to vindicate their religion and liberty. The Greek emperor, with a spirit unknown to his fathers, engaged to guard the Bosphorus and to sally from Constantinople at the head of his national and mercenary troops. The Sultan of Karamania announced the retreat of Amurath and a powerful diversion in the heart of Anatolia. And if the fleets of the West could occupy at the same moment the straits of the Hellespont, the Ottoman monarchy would be dissevered and destroyed. Heaven and earth must rejoice in the perdition of the miscreants, and the legate, with prudent ambiguity, instilled the opinion of the invisible, perhaps the visible, aid of the Son of God and his divine mother. Of the Polish and Hungarian diets, a religious war was the unanimous cry, and Ladislaus, after passing the Danube, led an army of his confederate subjects as far as Sofia, the capital of the Bulgarian kingdom. In this expedition they obtained two signal victories, which were justly ascribed to the valor and conduct of Hunyadis. In the first, with a vanguard of 10,000 men, he surprised the Turkish camp. In the second, he vanquished and made prisoner the most renowned of their generals, who possessed the double advantage of ground and numbers. The approach of winter and the natural and artificial obstacles of Mount Hemus arrested the progress of the hero, who measured a narrow interval of 6 days' march from the foot of the mountains to the hostile towers of Adrianople and the friendly capital of the Greek Empire. The retreat was undisturbed, and the entrance into Buda was at once a military and religious triumph. An ecclesiastical procession was followed by the king and his warriors on foot. He nicely balanced the merits and rewards of the two nations, and the pride of conquest was blended with the humble temper of Christianity. 13 bashaws, 9 standards, and 4,000 captives were unquestionable trophies, and as all were willing to believe and none were present to contradict, the crusaders multiplied with unblushing confidence the myriads of Turks whom they had left on the field of battle. The most solid proof and the most salutary consequence of victory was a deputation from the Divan to solicit peace, to restore Serbia, to ransom the prisoners, and to evacuate the Hungarian frontier. By this treaty, the rational objects of the war were obtained. The king, the despot, and Hunyadis himself, in the Diet of Segedin, were satisfied with public and private emolument. A truce of 10 years was concluded, and the followers of Jesus and Muhammad, who swore on the Gospel and the Quran, attested the Word of God as the guardian of truth and the avenger of perfidy. In the place of Gospel, the Turkish ministers had proposed to substitute the Eucharist, the real presence of the Catholic deity. But the Christians refused to profane their holy mysteries, and a superstitious conscience is less forcibly bound by the spiritual energy than by the outward and visible symbols of an oath. During the whole transaction, the cardinal legate had observed a sullen silence, unwilling to approve and unable to oppose the consent of the king and people. But the diet was not dissolved before Julian was fortified by the welcome intelligence that Anatolia was invaded by the Caramanian and Thrace by the Greek emperor, that the fleets of Genoa, Venice, and Burgundy were masters of the Hellespont, and that the allies, informed of the victory and ignorant of the treaty of Ladislaus, impatiently waited for the return of his victorious army. "And is it thus," exclaimed the cardinal, "that you will desert their expectations and your own fortune? It is to them, to your God and your fellow Christians, that you have pledged your faith, and that prior obligation annihilates a rash and sacrilegious oath to the enemies of Christ. His vicar on earth is the Roman pontiff, without whose sanction you can neither promise nor perform. In his name I absolve your perjury and sanctify your arms. Follow my footsteps in the paths of glory and salvation, and if still ye have scruples, devolve on my head the punishment and the sin." This mischievous casuistry was seconded by his respectable character and the levity of popular assemblies. War was resolved on the same spot where peace had so lately been sworn, and in the execution of the treaty the Turks were assaulted by the Christians, to whom, with some reason, they might apply the epithet of infidels. The falsehood of Ladislaus to his word and oath was palliated by the religion of the times. The most perfect, or at least the most popular, excuse would have been the success of his arms and the deliverance of the Eastern Church. But the same treaty which should have bound his conscience had diminished his strength. On the proclamation of the peace, the French and German volunteers departed with indignant murmurs. The Poles were exhausted by distant warfare, and perhaps disgusted with foreign command, and their palatines accepted the first license and hastily retired to their provinces and castles. Even Hungary was divided by faction, or restrained by a laudable scruple, and the relics of the crusade that marched in the second expedition were reduced to an inadequate force of 20,000 men. A Wallachian chief, who joined the royal standard with his vassals, presumed to remark that their numbers did not exceed the hunting retinue that sometimes attended the sultan, and the gift of two horses of matchless speed might admonish Ladislaus of his secret foresight of the event. But the despot of Serbia, after the restoration of his country and children, was tempted by the promise of new realms, and the inexperience of the king, the enthusiasm of the legate, and the martial presumption of Hunyadi's himself, were persuaded that every obstacle must yield to the invincible virtue of the sword and the cross. After the passage of the Danube, two roads might lead to Constantinople and the Hellespont, the one direct, abrupt, and difficult, through the mountains of Hemus, the other more tedious and secure, over a level country and along the shores of the Black Sea, in which their flanks, according to the Scythian discipline, might always be covered by a movable fortification of wagons. The latter was judiciously preferred. The Catholics marched through the plains of Bulgaria, burning with wanton cruelty the churches and villages of the Christian natives, and their last station was at Warna, near the seashore. on which the defeat and death of Ladislaus have bestowed a memorable name. It was on this fatal spot that, instead of finding a Confederate fleet to second their operations, they were alarmed by the approach of Amurath himself, who had issued from his Magnesian solitude and transported the forces of Asia to the defense of Europe. According to some writers, the Greek emperor had been awed, or seduced, to grant the passage of the Bosphorus, and an indelible strain of corruption is fixed on the Genoese, or the Pope's nephew, the Catholic admiral whose mercenary connivance betrayed the guard of the Hellespont. From Adrianople the Sultan advanced by heavy marches at the head of 60,000 men, and when the Cardinal and Hunyadis had taken a nearer survey of the numbers and order of the Turks, these ardent warriors proposed the tardy and impracticable measure of a retreat. The king alone was resolved to conquer or die, and his resolution had almost been crowned with a glorious and salutary victory. The princes were opposite to each other in the center, and the Beglerbegs, or generals of Anatolia and Romania, commanded on the right and left against the adverse divisions of the despot and Hunyadis. The Turkish wings were broken on the first onset, but the advantage was fatal, and the rash victors, in the heat of the pursuit, were carried away far from the annoyance of the enemy or the support of their friends. When Amurath beheld the flight of his squadrons, he despaired of his fortune and that of the empire. A veteran Janissary seized his horse's bridle, and he had magnanimity to pardon and reward the soldier who dared to perceive the terror and arrest the flight of his sovereign. A copy of the treaty, the monument of Christian perfidy, had been displayed in the front of battle. And it is said that the Sultan, in his distress, lifting his eyes and his hands to heaven, implored the protection of the God of truth, and called on the prophet Jesus himself to avenge the impious mockery of his name and religion. With inferior numbers and disordered ranks, the King of Hungary rushed forward in the confidence of victory, till his career was stopped by the impenetrable phalanx of the Janissaries. If we may credit the Ottoman annals, his horse was pierced by the javelin of Amurath. He fell among the spears of the infantry, and a Turkish soldier proclaimed with a loud voice, "Hungarians, behold the head of your king." The death of Ladislaus was the signal of their defeat. On his return from an intemperate pursuit, Hunyadis deplored his error and the public loss. He strove to rescue the royal body till he was overwhelmed by the tumultuous crowd of the victors and vanquished, and the last efforts of his courage and conduct were exerted to save the remnant of his Wallachian cavalry. 10,000 Christians were slain in the disastrous Battle of Warna. The loss of the Turks, more considerable in numbers, bore a smaller proportion to their total strength. Yet the philosophic Sultan was not ashamed to confess that his ruin must be the consequence of a second and similar victory. At his command, a column was erected on the spot where Ladislaus had fallen, but the modest inscription, instead of accusing the rashness, recorded the valor and bewailed the misfortune of the Hungarian youth. Before I lose sight of the field of Warna, I am tempted to pause on the character and story of two principal actors, the Cardinal Julian and John Hunyadis. Julian Cesarini was born of a noble family of Rome. His studies had embraced both the Latin and Greek learning, both the sciences of divinity and law, and his versatile genius was equally adapted to the schools, the camp, and the court. No sooner had he been invested with the Roman purple than he was sent into Germany to arm the empire against the rebels and heretics of Bohemia. The spirit of persecution is unworthy of a Christian. The military profession ill becomes a priest. but the former is excused by the times, and the latter was ennobled by the courage of Julian, who stood dauntless and alone in the disgraceful flight of the German host. As the Pope's legate, he opened the Council of Basel, but the President soon appeared the most strenuous champion of ecclesiastical freedom, and an opposition of 7 years was conducted by his ability and zeal. After promoting the strongest measures against the authority and person of Eugenius, some secret motive of interest or conscience engaged him to desert on a sudden the popular party. The cardinal withdrew himself from Basel to Ferrara, and in the debates of the Greeks and Latins, the two nations admired the dexterity of his arguments and the depth of his theological erudition. In his Hungarian embassy, we have already seen the mischievous effects of his sophistry and eloquence, of which Julian himself was the first victim. The cardinal, who performed the duties of a priest and a soldier, was lost in the defeat of Warner. The circumstances of his death are variously related, but it is believed that a weighty encumbrance of gold impeded his flight and tempted the cruel avarice of some Christian fugitives. From a humble, or at least a doubtful, origin, the merit of John Hunyadi's promoted him to the command of the Hungarian armies. His father was a Wallachian, his mother a Greek. Her unknown race might possibly ascend to the emperors of Constantinople, and the claims of the Wallachians, with the surname of Corvinus from the place of his nativity, might suggest a thin pretense for mingling his blood with the patricians of ancient Rome. In his youth he served in the wars of Italy, and was returned, with 12 horsemen, by the Bishop of Zagreb. The valor of the White Knight was soon conspicuous. He increased his fortunes by a noble and wealthy marriage, and in the defense of the Hungarian borders, he won, in the same year, 3 battles against the Turks. By his influence, Ladislaus of Poland obtained the crown of Hungary, and the important service was rewarded by the title and office of Voivod of Transylvania. The first of Julian's crusades added 2 Turkish laurels on his brow, and in the public distress the fatal errors of Warner were forgotten. During the absence and minority of Ladislaus of Austria, the titular king, Hunyadis was elected supreme captain and governor of Hungary, and if envy at first was silenced by terror, a reign of 12 years supposes the arts of policy as well as of war. Yet the idea of a consummate general is not delineated in his campaigns. The White Knight fought with the hand rather than the head, as the chief of desultory barbarians who attack without fear and fly without shame. And his military life is composed of a romantic alternative of victories and escapes. By the Turks, who employed his name to frighten their perverse children, he was corruptly denominated Juncus Lane, or the Wicked. Their hatred is the proof of their esteem. The kingdom which he guarded was inaccessible to their arms, and they felt him most daring and formidable when they fondly believed the captain and his country irrecoverably lost. Instead of confining himself to a defensive war, 4 years after the defeat of Warner, he again penetrated into the heart of Bulgaria, and in the plain of Kosovo, sustained, till the third day, the shock of the Ottoman army, 4 times more numerous than his own. As he fled alone through the woods of Wallachia, the hero was surprised by 2 robbers. But while they disputed a gold chain that hung at his neck, he recovered his sword, slew the one, terrified the other, and after new perils of captivity or death, consoled by his presence an afflicted kingdom. But the last and most glorious action of his life was the defense of Belgrade against the powers of Mohammed II in person. After a siege of 40 days, the Turks, who had already entered the town, were compelled to retreat, and the joyful nation celebrated Hunyadis and Belgrade as the bulwarks of Christendom. About a month after this great deliverance, the champion expired, and his most splendid epitaph is the regret of the Ottoman prince, who sighed that he could no longer hope for revenge against the single antagonist who had triumphed over his arms. On the first vacancy of the throne, Matthias Corvinus, a youth of 18 years of age, was elected and crowned by the grateful Hungarians. His reign was prosperous and long. Matthias aspired to the glory of a conqueror and a saint. But his purest merit is the encouragement of learning, and the Latin orators and historians who were invited from Italy by the son have shed the luster of their eloquence on the father's character. In the list of heroes, John Hunyadis and Skanderbeg are commonly associated, and they are both entitled to our notice, since their occupation of the Ottoman arms delayed the ruin of the Greek Empire. John Castriot, the father of Skanderbeg, was the hereditary prince of a small district of Epirus, or Albania, between the mountains and the Adriatic Sea. Unable to contend with the sultan's power, Castriot submitted to the hard conditions of peace and tribute. He delivered his four sons as the pledges of his fidelity, and the Christian youths, after receiving the mark of circumcision, were instructed in the Mohammedan religion and trained in the arms and arts of Turkish policy. The three elder brothers were confounded in the crowd of slaves, and the poison to which their deaths are ascribed cannot be verified or disproved by any positive evidence. Yet the suspicion is, in a great measure, removed by the kind and paternal treatment of George Castriot, the fourth brother, who from his tender youth displayed the strength and spirit of a soldier. The successive overthrow of a Tatar and two Persians, who carried a proud defiance to the Turkish court, recommended him to the favor of Amurath, and his Turkish appellation of Skanderbeg, Iskender Beg, or the Lord Alexander, is an indelible memorial of his glory and servitude. His father's principality was reduced into a province, but the loss was compensated by the rank and title of Sanjak, a command of 5,000 horse, and the prospect of the first dignities of the empire. He served with honor in the wars of Europe and Asia, and we may smile at the art or credulity of the historian, who supposes that in every encounter he spared the Christians while he fell with a thundering arm on his Muslim foes. The glory of Hunyadis is without reproach. He fought in the defense of his religion and country. But the enemies who applaud the patriot have branded his rival with the name of traitor and apostate. In the eyes of the Christian, the rebellion of Skanderbeg is justified by his father's wrongs, the ambiguous death of his three brothers, his own degradation, and the slavery of his country. And they adore the generous, though tardy, zeal with which he asserted the faith and independence of his ancestors. But he had imbibed from his 9th year the doctrines of the Koran. He was ignorant of the gospel. The religion of a soldier is determined by authority and habit. Nor is it easy to conceive what new illumination at the age of 38 could be poured into his soul. His motives would be less exposed to the suspicion of interest or revenge had he broken his chain from the moment that he was sensible of its weight. But a long oblivion had surely impaired his original right, and every year of obedience and reward had cemented the mutual bond of the sultan and his subject. If Skanderbeg had long harbored the belief of Christianity and the intention of revolt, a worthy mind must condemn the base dissimulation that could serve only to betray, that could promise only to be forsworn, that could actively join in the temporal and spiritual perdition of so many thousands of his unhappy brethren. Shall we praise a secret correspondence with Hunyadis while he commanded the vanguard of the Turkish army? Shall we excuse the desertion of his standard? A treacherous desertion, which abandoned the victory to the enemies of his benefactor? In the confusion of a defeat, the eye of Skanderbeg was fixed on the res effendi, or principal secretary. With the dagger at his breast, he extorted a firman, or patent, for the government of Albania, and the murder of the guiltless scribe and his train prevented the consequences of an immediate discovery. With some bold companions, to whom he had revealed his design, he escaped in the night by rapid marches from the field or battle to his paternal mountains. The gates of Kroya were opened to the royal mandate, and no sooner did he command the fortress than George Gastriot dropped the mask of dissimulation, abjured the prophet and the sultan, and proclaimed himself the avenger of his family and country. The names of religion and liberty provoked a general revolt. The Albanians, a martial race, were unanimous to live and die with their hereditary prince, and the Ottoman garrisons were indulged in the choice of martyrdom or baptism. In the assembly of the states of Epirus, Skanderbeg was elected general of the Turkish war, and each of the allies engaged to furnish his respective proportion of men and money. From these contributions, from his patrimonial estate, and from the valuable salt pits of Selina, he drew an annual revenue of 200,000 ducats, and the entire sum, exempt from the demands of luxury, was strictly appropriated to the public use. His manners were popular, but his discipline was severe, and every superfluous vice was banished from his camp. His example strengthened his command, and under his conduct the Albanians were invincible in their own opinion and that of their enemies. The bravest adventurers of France and Germany were allured by his fame and retained in his service. His standing militia consisted of 8,000 horse and 7,000 foot. The horses were small, the men were active, but he viewed with a discerning eye the difficulties and resources of the mountains, and at the blaze of the beacons the whole nation was distributed in the strongest posts. With such unequal arms, Skanderbeg resisted 23 years the powers of the Ottoman Empire, and two conquerors, Amurath II and his greater son, were repeatedly baffled by a rebel whom they pursued with seeming contempt and implacable resentment. At the head of 60,000 horse and 40,000 Janissaries, Amurath entered Albania. He might ravage the open country, occupy the defenseless towns, convert the churches into mosques, circumcise the Christian youths, and punish with death his adult and obstinate captives. But the conquests of the sultan were confined to the petty fortress of Svetigrad, and the garrison, invincible to his arms, was oppressed by paltry artifice and a superstitious scruple. Amurath retired with shame and loss from the walls of Kroya, the castle and residence of the Castriots. The march, the siege, the retreat were harassed by a vexatious and almost invisible adversary, and the disappointment might tend to embitter, perhaps to shorten, the last days of the sultan. In the fullness of conquest, Mohammed II still felt at his bosom this domestic thorn. His lieutenants were permitted to negotiate a truce, and the Albanian prince may justly be praised as a firm and able champion of his national independence. The enthusiasm of chivalry and religion has ranked him with the names of Alexander and Pyrrhus, nor would they blush to acknowledge their intrepid countrymen. But his narrow dominion and slender powers must leave him at a humble distance below the heroes of antiquity who triumphed over the East and the Roman legions. His splendid achievements, the bashaws whom he encountered, the armies that he discomfited, and the 3,000 Turks who were slain by his single hand, must be weighed in the scales of suspicious criticism. against an illiterate enemy, and in the dark solitude of Epirus, his partial biographers may safely indulge the latitude of romance, but their fictions are exposed by the light of Italian history, and they afford a strong presumption against their own truth by a fabulous tale of his exploits, when he passed the Adriatic with 800 horse to the succour of the King of Naples. Without disparagement to his fame, they might have owned that he was finally oppressed by the Ottoman powers. In his extreme danger, he applied to Pope Pius II for a refuge in the ecclesiastical state, and his resources were almost exhausted since Scanderbeg died a fugitive at Lissus on the Venetian territory. His sepulchre was soon violated by the Turkish conquerors, but the Janissaries, who wore his bones enchased in a bracelet, declared by this superstitious amulet their involuntary reverence for his valour. The instant ruin of his country may redound to the hero's glory. Yet, had he balanced the consequences of submission and resistance, a patriot, perhaps, would have declined the unequal contest which must depend on the life and genius of one man. Scanderbeg might indeed be supported by the rational, though fallacious, hope that the Pope, the King of Naples, and the Venetian Republic would join in the defense of a free and Christian people who guarded the sea coast of the Adriatic and the narrow passage from Greece to Italy. His infant son was saved from the national shipwreck. The Castriots were invested with a Neapolitan dukedom, and their blood continues to flow in the noblest families of the realm. A colony of Albanian fugitives obtained a settlement in Calabria, and they preserve, at this day, the language and manners of their ancestors. In the long career of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, I have reached at length the last reign of the princes of Constantinople, who so feebly sustained the name and majesty of the Caesars. On the decease of John Palaeologus, who survived about 4 years the Hungarian Crusade, the royal family, by the death of Andronicus and the monastic profession of Isidore, was reduced to 3 princes, Constantine, Demetrius, and Thomas, the surviving sons of the Emperor Manuel. Of these, the first and last were far distant in the Morea, but Demetrius, who possessed the domain of Celebria, was in the suburbs at the head of a party. His ambition was not chilled by the public distress, and his conspiracy with the Turks and the schismatics had already disturbed the peace of his country. The funeral of the late emperor was accelerated with singular and even suspicious haste. The claim of Demetrius to the vacant throne was justified by trite and flimsy sophism, that he was born in the purple, the eldest son of his father's reign. But the empress mother, the senate and soldiers, the clergy and people, were unanimous in the cause of the lawful successor, and the despot Thomas, who, ignorant of the change, accidentally returned to the capital, asserted with becoming zeal the interest of his absent brother. An ambassador, the historian Franza, was immediately dispatched to the court of Adrianople. Amurath received him with honour and dismissed him with gifts, but the gracious approbation of the Turkish sultan announced his supremacy and the approaching downfall of the Eastern Empire. By the hands of 2 illustrious deputies, the imperial crown was placed at Sparta on the head of Constantine. In the spring, he sailed from the Morea, escaped the encounter of a Turkish squadron, enjoyed the acclamations of his subjects, celebrated the festival of a new reign, and exhausted by his donatives the treasure, or rather the indigence, of the state. The emperor immediately resigned to his brothers the possession of the Morea, and the brittle friendship of the 2 princes, Demetrius and Thomas, was confirmed in their mother's presence by the frail security of oaths and embraces. His next occupation was the choice of a consort. A daughter of the Doge of Venice had been proposed, but the Byzantine nobles objected. The distance between an hereditary monarch and an elective magistrate, and in their subsequent distress, the chief of that powerful republic was not unmindful of the affront. Constantine afterwards hesitated between the royal families of Trebizond and Georgia, and the embassy of Franza represents in his public and private life the last days of the Byzantine Empire. The Protovestiare, or Great Chamberlain, Franza, sailed from Constantinople as the minister of a bridegroom, and the relics of wealth and luxury were applied to his pompous appearance. His numerous retinue consisted of nobles and guards, of physicians and monks. He was attended by a band of music, and the term of his costly embassy was protracted above 2 years. On his arrival in Georgia, or Iberia, the natives from the towns and villages flocked around the strangers, and such was their simplicity that they were delighted with the effects without understanding the cause of musical harmony. Among the crowd was an old man, above 100 years of age, who had formerly been carried away a captive by the barbarians, and who amused his hearers with a tale of the wonders of India, from whence he had returned to Portugal by an unknown sea. From this hospitable land, Franza proceeded to the court of Trebizond, where he was informed by the Greek prince of the recent decease of Amurath. Instead of rejoicing in the deliverance, the experienced statesman expressed his apprehension that an ambitious youth would not long adhere to the sage and pacific system of his father. After the sultan's decease, his Christian wife, Maria, the daughter of the Serbian despot, had been honorably restored to her parents. On the fame of her beauty and merit, she was recommended by the ambassador as the most worthy object of the royal choice. And Franza recapitulates and refutes the specious objections that might be raised against the proposal. The majesty of the purple would ennoble an unequal alliance. The bar of affinity might be removed by liberal alms and the dispensation of the church. The disgrace of Turkish nuptials had been repeatedly overlooked, and though the fair Maria was nearly 50 years of age, she might yet hope to give an heir to the empire. Constantine listened to the advice, which was transmitted in the first ship that sailed from Trebizond, but the factions of the court opposed his marriage, and it was finally prevented by the pious vow of the Sultana, who ended her days in the monastic profession. Reduced to the first alternative, the choice of Franza was decided in favor of a Georgian princess, and the vanity of her father was dazzled by the glorious alliance. Instead of demanding, according to the primitive and national custom, a price for his daughter, he offered a portion of 56,000, with an annual pension of 5,000 ducats. And the services of the ambassador were repaid by an assurance that as his son had been adopted in baptism by the emperor, the establishment of his daughter should be the peculiar care of the Empress of Constantinople. On the return of Franza, the treaty was ratified by the Greek monarch, who, with his own hand, impressed 3 vermilion crosses on the golden bull and assured the Georgian envoy that in the spring his galleys should conduct the bride to her imperial palace. But Constantine embraced his faithful servant not with the cold approbation of a sovereign, but with the warm confidence of a friend, who, after a long absence, is impatient to pour his secrets into the bosom of his friend. Since the death of my mother, and of Cantacuzini, who alone advised me without interest or passion, I am surrounded, said the emperor, by men whom I can neither love nor trust nor esteem. You are not a stranger to Lucas Notaras, the great admiral. Obstinately attached to his own sentiments, he declares, both in private and public, that his sentiments are the absolute measure of my thoughts and actions. The rest of the courtiers are swayed by their personal or factious views. And how can I consult the monks on questions of policy and marriage? I have yet much employment for your diligence and fidelity. In the spring you shall engage one of my brothers to solicit the succor of the Western powers. From the Morea you shall sail to Cyprus on a particular commission, then from thence proceed to Georgia to receive and conduct the future empress. Your commands, replied Franza, are irresistible. But deign, great sir, he added with a serious smile, to consider that if I am thus perpetually absent from my family, my wife may be tempted either to seek another husband or to throw herself into a monastery. After laughing at his apprehensions, the emperor more gravely consoled him by the pleasing assurance that this should be his last service abroad, and that he destined for his son a wealthy and noble heiress. For himself, the important office of great logothete, or principal minister of state. The marriage was immediately stipulated, but the office, however incompatible with his own, had been usurped by the ambition of the admiral. Some delay was requisite to negotiate a consent and an equivalent, and the nomination of Franza was half declared and half suppressed, lest it might be displeasing to an insolent and powerful favorite. The winter was spent in the preparations of his embassy, and Franza had resolved that the youth, his son, should embrace this opportunity of foreign travel, and be left, on the appearance of danger, with his maternal kindred of the Morea. Such were the private and public designs which were interrupted by a Turkish war, and finally buried in the ruins of the empire. Chapter 68. Reign and Character of Mohammed II. Siege, Assault, and Final Conquest of Constantinople by the Turks. Death of Constantine Palaeologus. Servitude of the Greeks. Extinction of the Roman Empire in the East. Consternation of Europe. Conquests and death of Muhammad II. The siege of Constantinople by the Turks attracts our first attention to the person and character of the great destroyer. Muhammad II was the son of the second Amirath, and though his mother has been decorated with the titles of Christian and Princess, she is more probably confounded with the numerous concubines who peopled, from every climate, the harem of the Sultan. His first education and sentiments were those of a devout Muslim, and as often as he conversed with an infidel, he purified his hands and face by the legal rites of ablution. Age and empire appear to have relaxed this narrow bigotry. His aspiring genius disdained to acknowledge a power above his own, and in his looser hours he presumed, it is said, to brand the prophet of Mecca as a robber and impostor. Yet the Sultan persevered in a decent reverence for the doctrine and discipline of the Quran. His private indiscretion must have been sacred from the vulgar ear, and we should suspect the credulity of strangers and sectaries so prone to believe that a mind which is hardened against truth must be armed with superior contempt for absurdity and error. Under the tuition of the most skillful masters, Muhammad advanced with an early and rapid progress in the paths of knowledge, and besides his native tongue it is affirmed that he spoke or understood five languages: the Arabic, the Persian, the Chaldean or Hebrew, the Latin, and the Greek. The Persian might indeed contribute to his amusement and the Arabic to his edification, and such studies are familiar to the Oriental youth. In the intercourse of the Greeks and Turks, a conqueror might wish to converse with the people over which he was ambitious to reign. His own praises in Latin poetry or prose might find a passage to the royal ear, but what use or merit could recommend to the statesman or the scholar the uncouth dialect of his Hebrew slaves? The history and geography of the world were familiar to his memory. The lives of the heroes of the East, perhaps of the West, excited his emulation. His skill in astrology is excused by the folly of the times, and supposes some rudiments of mathematical science, and a profane taste for the arts is betrayed in his liberal invitation and reward of the painters of Italy. But the influence of religion and learning were employed without effect on his savage and licentious nature. I will not transcribe, nor do I firmly believe, the stories of his 14 pages, whose bellies were ripped open in search of a stolen melon, or of the beauteous slave whose head he severed from her body to convince the Janissaries that their master was not the votary of love. His sobriety is attested by the silence of the Turkish annals, which accuse three, and three only, of the Ottoman line of the vice of drunkenness. But it cannot be denied that his passions were at once furious and inexorable, that in the palace, as in the field, a torrent of blood was spilt on the slightest provocation, and that the noblest of the captive youth were often dishonored by his unnatural lust. In the Albanian war he studied the lessons, and soon surpassed the example of his father. And the conquest of 2 empires, 12 kingdoms, and 200 cities, a vain and flattering account, is ascribed to his invincible sword. He was doubtless a soldier and possibly a general. Constantinople has sealed his glory, but if we compare the means, the obstacles, and the achievements, Mohammed II must blush to sustain a parallel with Alexander or Timur. Under his command, the Ottoman forces were always more numerous than their enemies, yet their progress was bounded by the Euphrates and the Adriatic, and his arms were checked by Hunyadis and Skanderbeg, by the Rhodian knights, and by the Persian king. In the reign of Amurath he twice tasted of royalty and twice descended from the throne. His tender age was incapable of opposing his father's restoration, but never could he forgive the viziers who had recommended that salutary measure. His nuptials were celebrated with the daughter of a Turkman emir, and after a festival of 2 months, he departed from Adrianople with his bride to reside in the government of Magnesia. Before the end of 6 weeks he was recalled by a sudden message from the Divan, which announced the decease of Amurath and the mutinous spirit of the Janissaries. His speed and vigor commanded their obedience. He passed the Hellespont with a chosen guard, and at the distance of 1 mile from Adrianople, the viziers and emirs, the imams and cadis, the soldiers and the people, fell prostrate before the new sultan. They affected to weep. They affected to rejoice. He ascended the throne at the age of 21 years, and removed the cause of sedition by the death, the inevitable death, of his infant brothers. The ambassadors of Europe and Asia soon appeared to congratulate his accession and solicit his friendship, and to all he spoke the language of moderation and peace. The confidence of the Greek emperor was revived by the solemn oaths and fair assurances with which he sealed the ratification of the treaty, and a rich domain on the banks of the Strymon was assigned for the annual payment of 300,000 aspers, the pension of an Ottoman prince who was detained at his request in the Byzantine court. Yet the neighbors of Mohammed might tremble at the severity with which a youthful monarch reformed the pomp of his father's household. The expenses of luxury were applied to those of ambition, and a useless train of 7,000 falconers was either dismissed from his service or enlisted in his troops. In the first summer of his reign, he visited with an army the Asiatic provinces, but after humbling the pride, Muhammad accepted the submission of the Karamanian, that he might not be diverted by the smallest obstacle from the execution of his great design. The Mohammedan, and more especially the Turkish causists, have pronounced that no promise can bind the faithful against the interest and duty of their religion, and that the Sultan may abrogate his own treaties and those of his predecessors. The justice and magnanimity of Amurat had scorned this immoral privilege, but his son, though the proudest of men, could stoop from ambition to the basest arts of dissimulation and deceit. Peace was on his lips while war was in his heart. He incessantly sighed for the possession of Constantinople. And the Greeks, by their own indiscretion, afforded the first pretense of the fatal rupture. Instead of laboring to be forgotten, their ambassadors pursued his camp to demand the payment and even the increase of their annual stipend. The divan was importuned by their complaints, and the vizier, a secret friend of the Christians, was constrained to deliver the sense of his brethren. "Ye foolish and miserable Romans," said Khalil, "we know your devices, and ye are ignorant of your own danger. The unscrupulous Amurath is no more. His throne is occupied by a young conqueror, whom no laws can bind and no obstacles can resist. And if you escape from his hands, give praise to the divine clemency which yet delays the chastisement of your sins. Why do ye seek to affright us by vain and indirect menaces? Release the fugitive Orkan, crown him Sultan of Romania. Call the Hungarians from beyond the Danube, arm against us the nations of the West, and be assured that you will only provoke and precipitate your ruin." But if the fears of the ambassadors were alarmed by the stern language of the vizier, they were soothed by the courteous audience and friendly speeches of the Ottoman prince. And Muhammad assured them that on his return to Adrianople, he would redress the grievances and consult the true interests of the Greeks. No sooner had he repassed the Hellespont than he issued a mandate to suppress their pension and to expel their officers from the banks of the Strymon. In this measure he betrayed a hostile mind, and the second order announced and in some degree commenced the siege of Constantinople. In the narrow pass of the Bosphorus, an Asiatic fortress had formerly been raised by his grandfather. In the opposite situation on the European side, he resolved to erect a more formidable castle, and 1,000 masons were commanded to assemble in the spring on a spot named Assomaton, about 5 miles from the Greek metropolis. Persuasion is the resource of the feeble, and the feeble can seldom persuade. The ambassadors of the emperor attempted without success to divert Muhammad from the execution of his design. They represented that his grandfather had solicited the permission of Manuel to build a castle on his own territories, but that this double fortification, which would command the strait, could only tend to violate the alliance of the nations, to intercept the Latins who traded in the Black Sea, and perhaps to annihilate the subsistence of the city. "I formed the enterprise," replied the perfidious sultan, "against the city. But the empire of Constantinople is measured by her walls. Have you forgot the distress to which my father was reduced when you formed a league with the Hungarians? When they invaded our country by land and the Hellespont was occupied by the French galleys? Amurath was compelled to force the passage of the Bosphorus, and your strength was not equal to your malevolence. I was then a child at Adrianople. The Muslims trembled, and for a while the Gabours insulted our disgrace. But when my father had triumphed in the field of Warna, he vowed to erect a fort on the western shore, and that vow it is my duty to accomplish. Have ye the right, have ye the power, to control my actions on my own ground? For that ground is my own, as far as the shores of the Bosphorus. Asia is inhabited by the Turks, and Europe is deserted by the Romans. Return, and inform your king that the present Ottoman is far different from his predecessors, that his resolutions surpass their wishes, and that he performs more than they could resolve. Return in safety. But the next who delivers a similar message may expect to be flayed alive. After this declaration, Constantine, the first of the Greeks in spirit as in rank, determined to unsheathe the sword and to resist the approach and establishment of the Turks on the Bosphorus. He was disarmed by the advice of his civil and ecclesiastical ministers, who recommended a system less generous and even less prudent than his own, to approve their patience and long-suffering, to brand the Ottoman with the name and guilt of an aggressor, and to depend on chance and time for their own safety, and the destruction of a fort which could not long be maintained in the neighborhood of a great and populous city. Amidst hope and fear, the fears of the wise and the hopes of the credulous, the winter rolled away. The proper business of each man and each hour was postponed, and the Greeks shut their eyes against the impending danger till the arrival of the spring and the Sultan decided the assurance of their ruin. Of a master who never forgives, the orders are seldom disobeyed. On the 26th of March, the appointed spot of Assomaton was covered with an active swarm of Turkish artificers, and the materials by sea and land were diligently transported from Europe and Asia. The lime had been burnt in Kataphrygia. The timber was cut down in the woods of Heraclea and Nicomedia. Then the stones were dug from the Anatolian quarries. Each of the 1,000 masons was assisted by 2 workmen, and a measure of 2 cubits was marked for their daily task. The fortress was built in a triangular form. Each angle was flanked by a strong and massy tower, one on the declivity of the hill, 2 along the seashore. A thickness of 22 feet was assigned for the walls, 30 for the towers, and the whole building was covered with a solid platform of lead. Mohammed himself pressed and directed the work with indefatigable ardor. His 3 viziers claim the honor of finishing their respective towers. The zeal of the Cadis emulated that of the Janissaries. The meanest labor was ennobled by the service of God and the Sultan, and the diligence of the multitude was quickened by the eye of a despot, whose smile was the hope of fortune, and whose frown was the messenger of death. The Greek emperor beheld with terror the irresistible progress of the work, and vainly strove by flattery and gifts to assuage an implacable foe who sought and secretly fomented the slightest occasion of a quarrel. Such occasions must soon and inevitably be found. The ruins of stately churches, and even the marble columns which had been consecrated to Saint Michael the Archangel, were employed without scruple by the profane and rapacious Muslims, and some Christians, who presumed to oppose the removal, received from their hands the crown of martyrdom. Constantine had solicited a Turkish guard to protect the fields and harvests of his subjects. The guard was fixed. But their first order was to allow free pasture to the mules and horses of the camp, and to defend their brethren if they should be molested by the natives. The retinue of an Ottoman chief had left their horses to pass the night among the ripe corn. The damage was felt. The insult was resented, and several of both nations were slain in a tumultuous conflict. Mohammed listened with joy to the complaint, and a detachment was commanded to exterminate the guilty village. The guilty had fled, but 40 innocent and unsuspecting reapers were massacred by the soldiers. To this provocation Constantinople had been opened to the visits of commerce and curiosity. On the first alarm, the gates were shut. But the emperor, still anxious for peace, released on the third day his Turkish captives, and expressed in a last message the firm resignation of a Christian and a soldier. Since neither oaths, nor treaty, nor submission can secure peace, pursue, said he to Muhammad, your impious warfare. My trust is in God alone. If it should please him to mollify your heart, I shall rejoice in the happy change. If he delivers the city into your hands, I submit without a murmur to his holy will. But until the judge of the earth shall pronounce between us, it is my duty to live and die in the defense of my people. The Sultan's answer was hostile and decisive. His fortifications were completed, and before his departure for Adrianople, he stationed a vigilant aga and 400 Janissaries to levy a tribute on the ships of every nation that should pass within the reach of their cannon. A Venetian vessel, refusing obedience to the new lords of the Bosphorus, was sunk with a single bullet. The master and 30 sailors escaped in the boat, but they were dragged in chains to the port. The chief was impaled. His companions were beheaded, and the historian Ducas beheld at Demotica their bodies exposed to the wild beasts. The siege of Constantinople was deferred till the ensuing spring. But an Ottoman army marched into the Morea to divert the force of the brothers of Constantine. At this era of calamity, one of these princes, the despot Thomas, was blessed or afflicted with the birth of a son, the last heir, says the plaintive Franza, of the last spark of the Roman Empire. The Greeks and the Turks passed an anxious and sleepless winter. The former were kept awake by their fears, the latter by their hopes, both by the preparations of defense and attack. And the two emperors, who had the most to lose or to gain, were the most deeply affected by the national sentiment. In Muhammad, that sentiment was inflamed by the ardor of his youth and temper. He amused his leisure with building at Adrianople the lofty palace of Jehanuma, the watchtower of the world. But his serious thoughts were irrevocably bent on the conquest of the city of Caesar. At the dead of night, about the second watch, he started from his bed and commanded the instant attendance of his prime vizier. The message, the hour, the prince, and his own situation alarmed the guilty conscience of Khalil Basha, who had possessed the confidence and advised the restoration of Amurath. On the accession of the son, the vizier was confirmed in his office and the appearances of favor. But the veteran statesman was not insensible that he trod on a thin and slippery ice, which might break under his footsteps and plunge him in the abyss. His friendship for the Christians, which might be innocent under the late reign, had stigmatized him with the name of Gabur Ortaki, or foster brother of the infidels, and his avarice entertained a venal and treasonable correspondence which was detected and punished after the conclusion of the war. On receiving the royal mandate, he embraced, perhaps for the last time, his wife and children, filled a cup with pieces of gold, hastened to the palace, adored the sultan, and offered, according to the Oriental custom, the slight tribute of his duty and gratitude. It is not my wish, said Muhammad, to resume my gifts, but rather to heap and multiply them on thy head. In my turn I ask a present far more valuable and important. Constantinople. As soon as the vizier had recovered from his surprise, the same God, said he, who has already given thee so large a portion of the Roman Empire, will not deny the remnant and the capital. His providence and thy power assure thy success, and myself, with the rest of thy faithful slaves, will sacrifice our lives and fortunes. Lala or preceptor, continued the Sultan, do you see this pillow? All the night in my agitation I have pulled it on one side and the other. I have risen from my bed. Again have I lain down, yet sleep has not visited these weary eyes. Beware of the gold and silver of the Romans. In arms we are superior, and with the aid of God and the prayers of the prophet, we shall speedily become masters of Constantinople. To sound the disposition of his soldiers, he often wandered through the streets, alone and in disguise, and it was fatal to discover the Sultan when he wished to escape from the vulgar eye. His hours were spent in delineating the plan of the hostile city, in debating with his generals and engineers on what spot he should erect his batteries, on which side he should assault the walls, where he should spring his mines, to what place he should apply his scaling ladders, and the exercises of the day repeated and proved the lucubrations of the night. Among the implements of destruction, he studied with peculiar care the recent and tremendous discovery of the Latins, and his artillery surpassed whatever had yet appeared in the world. A founder of cannon, a Dane or Hungarian, who had been almost starved in the Greek service, deserted to the Muslims, and was liberally entertained by the Turkish Sultan. Muhammad was satisfied with the answer to his first question, which he eagerly pressed on the artist. Am I able to cast a cannon capable of throwing a ball or stone of sufficient size to batter the walls of Constantinople? I am not ignorant of their strength, but were they more solid than those of Babylon, I could oppose an engine of superior power. The position and management of that engine must be left to your engineers. On this assurance, a foundry was established at Adrianople. The metal was prepared, and at the end of 3 months, Urban produced a piece of brass ordnance of stupendous and almost incredible magnitude. A measure of 12 palms is assigned to the bore, and the stone bullet weighed above 600 pounds. A vacant place before the new palace was chosen for the first experiment. But to prevent the sudden and mischievous effects of astonishment and fear, a proclamation was issued that the cannon would be discharged the ensuing day. The explosion was felt or heard in a circuit of 100 furlongs. The ball, by the force of gunpowder, was driven above 1 mile, and on the spot where it fell, it buried itself 1 fathom deep in the ground. For the conveyance of this destructive engine, a frame or carriage of 30 wagons was linked together and drawn along by a team of 60 oxen. 200 men on both sides were stationed to poise and support the rolling weight. 250 workmen marched before to smooth the way and repair the bridges, and near 2 months were employed in a laborious journey of 150 miles. A lively philosopher derides on this occasion the credulity of the Greeks, and observes with much reason that we should always distrust the exaggerations of a vanquished people. He calculates that a ball, even of 200 pounds, would require a charge of 150 pounds of powder, and that the stroke would be feeble and impotent, since not a 1/15th part of the mass could be inflamed at the same moment. A stranger as I am to the art of destruction, I can discern that the modern improvements of artillery prefer the number of pieces to the weight of metal, the quickness of the fire to the sound, or even the consequence of a single explosion. Yet I dare not reject the positive and unanimous evidence of contemporary writers, nor can it seem improbable that the first artists, in their rude and